Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey everyone, it's me, Reed Galen. As you may have noticed, I don't host the Lincoln Project podcast anymore, but I'm so excited to share with you my brand new show, The Homefront. On The Homefront, you'll get the same incisive discourse about the pro-democracy movement from the smartest, most driven people in the fight today. If you're listening to this episode on the Lincoln Project podcast channel, I invite you to subscribe to The Homefront on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. I want to say thank you to all of you in the pro-democracy movement, and I look forward to continuing our American journey together. And now, The Homefront. Welcome to The Homefront. I'm your host, Reed Galen. Today, I'm delighted to welcome back journalist and political reporter Abigail Tracy. You know her from Inc. magazine, Forbes, and most recently, Vanity Fair. Today, she's once again coming to us from Washington, D.C. Abby, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here.
All right. So I am coming to everybody from jolly old England. So I'm doing a TV thing, I guess, Monday night. So, Abby, there's lots going on here. We're now, as folks are listening to this, we're about 6 weeks away from Election Day. A lot going on. So let's talk about some of the things that aren't Republican scandal related that I think are interesting and certainly of the more prurient nature. But I'm not entirely sure, other than the guy in North Carolina, how much voters actually care about it. So let's start here. This week, the Teamsters Union, one of the biggest unions in the country, truckers, drivers, et cetera, declined to make an endorsement in the presidential race. I think it was the first time in a long time they hadn't. And they went through a whole bunch of tortured reasoning to show that, that they'd polled their members and that, you know, when it was Biden, that he was the clear winner as far as an endorsement was concerned. But with Harris in the race now, Trump looked like maybe within the membership he was more popular. But the bottom line was the executive committee headed by Sean O'Brien, who famous or infamously spoke at the Republican convention earlier this summer, declined to issue an endorsement on behalf of either candidate. But that did not stop many, many of the Teamsters locals from sea to shining sea from weighing in on behalf of Vice President Harris. So what do you think about that?
I think it's certainly telling. You know, I'm not sure if you caught, there was a poll, I think Politico reported on it, that found that roughly 60% of Teamster members, you know, kind of lean toward Donald Trump in their support. And it really is kind of interesting that they opted in a vote of 14-3 to not endorse either candidate in all of this. And in a way, I think for Harris, it's sort of a best case scenario of a bad situation in a way. Obviously, there are, you know, all of the other really major labor unions have sort of lined up behind her in the presidential contest. But like for her, I think the fact that they didn't endorse is a big deal and a positive. You know, they're opting not to kind of influence or sway the race, despite the fact that, you know, a majority of their members via this survey did express support for Donald Trump. So I actually think ultimately at the end of the day, it's a blow for Donald Trump and a win for Kamala Harris.
And to your point, the story quickly became not the fact that the Nationals had not endorsed anyone, but that so many of the locals did. And that so much of organized labor, remember, was up in arms when O'Brien, who's got this sort of pugnacious manner about him, he almost got into a fight with Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen earlier this summer in a hearing. And just as an aside, we should remember that Mark Wayne Mullen's name was Mark Wayne Mullen when he was a member of Congress. And then when he ran for Senate, made his first name Mark Wayne, just to be more Oklahoma, if such a thing is possible. But that's neither here nor there.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
I didn't know this. He mushed his names together?
Yes. So he could be Mark Wayne, which is neither here nor there, but is also very Oklahoma to all my Sooner friends out there. Yeah. And so, you know, O'Brien, you know, he is under a lot of pressure. I'm sure the Trump people were all over him. get your people to do this. And he said, the best I can come up with is a non-endorsement. But of course, that, to your point, blew up in both in his face, and I think, as you're right, into Harris's favor as well. So, and you know, I think that's one of those things too, Abby, is that, you know, organized labor has been on the side of Democrats for decades. Not surprisingly, you know, Republicans have been singularly anti-organized labor, whether it comes to public employee unions like teachers, or it comes to the building trades, whether it's Teamsters or carpenters or whoever, you know, the culinary union. Obviously, Nevada is always famously influential, theoretically. And so that's one of those things, too, that, you know, with O'Brien, he has to know that even if his individual member is Trumpy in disposition, that a Trump presidency is probably ultimately bad for organized labor, if that makes sense, which is, even if you like the fact that Trump is a horse's ass and he's boorish and he makes you feel good because you're a middle-aged white guy and he's an, you know, asshole middle-aged white guy, the truth is that, like, he is, you know, the whole famous, like, he's not your best interest. He's not your best option.
Right. And I think it's, you know, it's easy to forget, kind of given the flow of the news and sort of the fact that we're all drinking from a fire hose at this point. But if you really think back to Donald Trump's chat with, I believe it was with Elon Musk on X, formerly Twitter, wherein he said, fire all the workers that want to go on strike. Was that the right chat? You know, sometimes things get muddled, but it really is kind of flies in the face of what unions such as the Teamsters are doing in terms of organized labor.
Yeah, because he probably also, somebody probably told him that Ronald Reagan fired all of the air traffic controllers, I think, in 1981. And Trump liked the idea of that. Now, of course, remember that Trump never fires anybody. He never actually fired anybody on his TV show, and he never actually fired anybody in the White House. He always had somebody else do it or treated them so poorly that they ultimately left. But this guy is a gigantic coward chicken, whatever the case might be, when it actually comes to firing people. And then once they quit, of course, they're the worst people that ever lived. So, I mean, again, I think it's one of those things where, you know, in some ways, everything old is new again in politics, right? Which is, here we are, you know, again, 6 weeks from an election in 2024, and we're talking about a major union endorsement, right? If you had told me that that was going to pop up as an issue, I don't think I would have believed you, given all the other things going on.
Yeah, I guess it's like, what is your sort of reaction? Were you surprised at the non-endorsement? Like, was it a shock to you, kind of given somebody who has courted, you know, groups such as this in the past?
No, I mean, I think it was a combination of, you know, not surprising. You know, it wasn't terribly surprising. Just again, given the nature of, I think, O'Brien personally, the fact that he had, I don't know if he had, you know, angled for a spot in Milwaukee. I think maybe he was not invited to speak in Chicago. So maybe there was also some personal animus. But as you know, too, with some of these groups, you know, so much of it comes down to ego and personality and, oh, you know, oh, well, they didn't make me, you know, this promise or that promise, which is ironic, of course, because I think in one of the major legislative packages that Biden and Harris, in fact, it might have been Harris that cast the tie-breaking vote, the Teamsters were massive beneficiaries of, infrastructure spending. And a lot of those dollars that are flowing not only nationally, but down into the state. So, again, am I surprised? It's almost impossible to surprise me, Abby, at this point about anything. All right. Let's talk about Georgia. So let's head on. The devil went down to Georgia and he took the form of elections canvassers and election boards in the counties there. And this is something that you were interested in talking about. And, you know, it's one of those things where I think I've tried to explain this, and I might have either written it on Twitter or maybe I wrote it on Substack, is that, and it's also, we're seeing this now in Nebraska, where, you know, Nebraska is one of the two states that divvies up their electoral votes, not winner take all, but by congressional district. And I think the Republicans, in fact, it might happen by the time people are listening to this, have famously changed the rules to make Nebraska winner state take
all. Well, how many times has Lindsey Graham gone to Nebraska now to try to push them for a winner take all vibe?
I know. Well, but, you know, listen, he went to Georgia first in 2020 to try and convince them to give, you know, Donald Trump 11,280 votes. But Georgia is one of those places where obviously it has a history of voter suppression. It was one of the states that was subject to what was called preclearance under the Voting Rights Act until the Supreme Court gutted that a few years ago. And so now it has passed all of these rules, like the whole idea of like the last season of the Larry David show of Curb Your Enthusiasm was all predicated on the idea that Larry accidentally gave somebody a bottle of water while they were standing in line to vote, right? And he got arrested for it, and that sort of became the whole thing. But again, this idea of it's, you know, there's a long line, people are there, you can't give them water. Why not? Because it will encourage people to stay in line. A thirsty person who's tired or whatever, who's at the end of that line, might leave if they can't, you know, do that. So it's just, it's not surprising. And I think it's also interesting, as I think we might have talked about on another episode. This to me is, I think, the height of cynicism for Brian Kemp, in that, you know, he would not help Trump in 2020. Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, would not help Donald Trump steal the election, as Donald Trump and his attorney, Cleta Mitchell, who's at the middle of all this too, a longtime conservative attorney, are on the phone pressuring Raffensperger to come up with these votes. And just as we're noting, as I think I might have said previously, like 11,000 votes, even in a state the size of Georgia, is not a close election. Right. That's a massive election. There's no way we missed by 11,000 votes. And so now we see yet another situation in which they're going to hand tabulate or hand recount every ballot on election night. Well, that could be millions and millions and millions of ballots that have to be retabulated, have to be recounted, all predicated on BS, on, you know, Dinesh D'Souza's 2000 mules. And, you know, the poor women, Shay and Miss Ruby, from the January 6th hearings, who were accused of manipulating ballots on election night in 2020 when they didn't, and ended up getting death threats, having to change the way they lived their lives. And so this is just another example of Republicans will change the rules of the game if the rules of the game don't suit them. And I think it's one thing that, you know, I think it was maybe Simon Rosenberg who said, we have to bury them under enough votes that they can't steal it.
Yeah, I guess, like, sort of in your opinion, why do you think Georgia in particular, obviously, you know, it does have this history of voter suppression and all of these things. You know, you mentioned the Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes. But, like, why do you think Georgia has become such a kind of boiling point for so many of these things? You know, we're seeing authority given to local election officials, you know, to have the ability to not certify the results, you know, Fulton County's, you know, bringing in a third party to certify the results. Like, why do you think Georgia has become this sort of boiling point of a lot of these debates around, you know, election integrity?
I think first and foremost, because it's one of the only electoral college, you know, key electoral college states in which the Republicans could do it. The other one theoretically would be North Carolina, but they have a Democratic governor there. So he would veto any silliness that they would try and enact, although the Republican legislature there in North Carolina is crazy, too. But I think that's it. And I think also that the idea that Donald Trump lost the state of Georgia in 2020, I think still boggles and baffles and upsets a lot of Republicans. I mean, this is not, you know, this is not Minnesota, right? This is not Illinois. This is Georgia. You know, this is, you know, the biggest, you know, the biggest state in the South, right? Atlanta is sort of the hub of the South. And the idea here that you could do this, I would also, Abby, not put past the fact that Fani Willis, who brought a RICO charge or a series of RICO charges against Donald Trump for trying to steal the 2020 election, that this might be, you know, retribution for that, too. They can't do it in Arizona. You know, my guess is Joe Lombardo, even though he's a little bit sort of pseudo-Trumpy in Nevada, you know, isn't going to do it there. My guess is, too, is that they never thought that Nevada was going to be in play until Harris was in the race. It's not going to happen in it's not going to happen in Wisconsin. It's not going to happen in Pennsylvania. It's not going to happen in Michigan. And those are all really the states that are up for grabs. And so this is the one place where I think they can, again, change the rules in the middle of the game to try and benefit Donald Trump. Again, to me, with the whole idea, I think from Kemp's perspective, that he's hoping to God that Trump wins Georgia, so he, like, outright, so that this doesn't matter, but loses the election, if that makes sense. Like, that's, for Brian Kemp's political future, that's the best possible outcome, that Trump actually does win Georgia fair and square, but he loses the overall election, so that he can say, when it came time, I did my part. And so, again, we should never forget that, you know, that I don't know. I mean, let me ask you, is a scary ideology like J.D. Vance or overweening ambition like Brian Kemp? Like, which is scarier? I mean, I wrestle with that. I think they're both awful, but the ambition part is scarier to me because it means that as much as I find J.D. Vance's ideology odious, you could make an argument that like a Kemp or a, what's her name from upstate New York, Elise Stefanik, right? They'll do anything.
Yeah, I think the scariest thing is actually when those two things converge. I think when you get the ideology that meets that, you know, raw ambition is the scariest thing. I do think there is something to be said, you know, around this idea that I think there are a number of members of Congress, and I'm not sure if you and I have talked about this, but like, I do think there are the true believers that really do, you know, assign themselves to this kind of like, quote unquote, like mega ideology, who like really believe in these things, who believe in these conspiracy theories, who believe in QAnon, who believe in, you know, all of this craziness.
Right. So Marjorie Taylor Greene would be that in Georgia.
Sure. Yes, she is. I would put her in that camp. And then I think there are people that, you know, have identified this as a opportunistic, ambitious route to, you know, boosting themselves politically. And they've just kind of grabbed on to sort of the, you know, the tales of Trumpism to make themselves better. And I actually think that, you know, the individuals I find the ones who are choosing this path, you know, who are choosing to, you know, promote these things, say these things, amplify these messages as scarier because, you know, I don't think they necessarily believe it, but what I think they see is opportunism and they're leaping at it. You know, I would put individuals such as Matt Gaetz in that camp. I would put Elise Stefanik. I would put, you know,
Josh Hawley.
You know, I think a lot of these individuals that really saw that this is kind of the path forward in terms of the Republican Party. And we've seen that, right? Like Donald Trump lost the 2020 election, and yet you still have Republicans across the country bending over backwards to try to appease and please him. And that really speaks to, I think, his grip on the party. You didn't see that when Mitt Romney lost in 2012. You know, nobody was looking to him for like guidance as to like, okay, what, you know, crazy idea or conspiracy theory do I push now? But you are still continuing to see that with Trump. If he loses in 2024, TBD a little bit, but we'll see. I think, you know, you look at a J.D. Vance, and I think that J.D. Vance is an individual who actually embraces MAGA in a far more real way and scary way than Donald Trump himself.
Sure. No, and I think he is one of those, like a Tucker Carlson even, who started out on the ambition train and then caught the bullet train to crazy on the way, if that makes sense. I think you're 100% right. The other part, too, is, you know, we should mention, you know, the Ron DeSantis of the world is when Trump speaks to MAGA, he speaks, to your point, from an ideological perspective, he might not be as pure, I guess, an ultra MAGA as J.D. Vance, but he's the native speaker, right? He's the one from which all the other messaging and the words and the direction flow. And the rest of them, it's like they're speaking through Google Translate. They say the same words, but it doesn't sound the same to the people who are listening. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's not the same thing.
Well, I think one of the things is like you look at a number of the ideas that J.D. Vance in particular, as an example, is promoting, you know, sort of this idea around even trying to give individuals that have children like greater rights in democracy, you know, providing greater votes to them. Like a lot of these ideas have kind of existed within the Republican Party, but on the far, far fringe and in a way that has not been, you know, mainstream at all. But what they have in Donald Trump is a microphone and a messenger and an individual who is able to kind of package them in a way that is palatable, despite the fact that these are fringe ideas. Like these aren't mainstream Republican ideas. And Donald Trump is good at that. Like I hate to say it, you know, but there's a reason why he won in 2016, you know, the Electoral College, but like there's a reason why he won. There's a reason why he's continued to like have this grip on the party. And it is because he is good at branding and in a way wherein he can tap into people's anger and kind of figure out exactly sort of what that touchstone is for these individuals that can get them, you know, riled up and backing this idea. And I think we talked about this last week. Then on top of it, you have an individual who is never going to admit fault, never going to back down. He's going to triple, quadruple, double down, you know, on anything he says, lie or truth. And so I think what you have with that is, you know, you have this vehicle of delivery for individuals who, you know, such as a J.D. Vance, who actually probably maybe believe in some of these more fringe ideas in a way that Donald Trump might not actually, but he sees in them power.
Right. And I think Trump actually thinks Vance is really weird. And I bet he would be like, he needs to stop saying that stuff because it sounds weird. Now, when Trump is saying that, right, you know, like, wait a second. Wait. But yeah, I think your broader point is the right one, which is Trump serves as the vehicle into which all of the MAGA base puts their fear, anger, resentment, whatever the case might be. Vance is there. He's the tribune. He's saying the right things. And I think he believes the things that a lot of the base believes, but also a lot of what the, you know, the Opus Dei Catholics believe. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of dark money right wingers out there that, you know, Peter Thiel, right, Elon Musk, all of these people, that Vance is the vanguard for their very strange in-state Ayn Rand, you know, sort of, you know, fascistic libertarianism. You know, I've got what I want. You're going to get stuck in the caste you're in. You know, this, I'm listening to another podcast called Behind the Bastards about this guy, Curtis Yarvin, who's sort of the, you know, the godfather of this ideology, right? I mean, guys, when we talk about this stuff, I think it's important to remember, as we're talking about the ideology here, the reason it matters is because there are very wealthy and powerful people who spend years and years and billions of dollars trying to make this stuff come to fruition. And as I've said, they got lucky with Trump. All of their preparation was in the idea that someone like Trump would come along who didn't really care about anything they believed in, but was willing to take it all the way to the mountaintop just because they needed each other. He wanted the power. He wanted the aggrandizement. They were fine with that because, you know what? They got the judges. And they got the weirdo policy and they got all the other stuff. And now here we are 6 weeks away. And this is why I think this stuff matters, both when Trump loses or if he wins, which is if he wins, this stuff becomes policy. And if he loses, again, these people aren't going away. And frankly, I don't think Trump's going away either.
I think kind of to your point, I do think that when J.D. Vance sees Taylor Swift, what J.D. Vance does literally see is a childish cat lady. Like, right. That is what he sees when he sees Taylor Swift. And, like, for some reason, he has a personal animus toward that. I think when Donald Trump sees Taylor Swift, like, he doesn't give a shit about the fact that she doesn't have kids and might own cats. But what he does care about is the fact that she didn't endorse him.
And she's more famous and, frankly, richer than he is.
Exactly. And I think like, and I kind of think like, you know, not to make it all about Taylor Swift and the endorsement, but I like actually do believe that there is something sort of about her and kind of the conversation and the narrative around her in this election that really can put a point on who J.D. Vance is relative to who Donald Trump is. And like, I think that J.D. Vance really believes these views around, you know, procreating and family and building family and the fact that, you know, individuals with children should have a greater say in democracy, which is something that he has promoted in the past. Whereas I think ultimately, as we've seen for years and years and years at this point, Donald Trump is out for himself 100%. That's his only interest. He doesn't care about procreation and, you know, populating the planet and, you know, all of these things. Like what Donald Trump cares about is Donald Trump. You know, above his children, above his wife, like above anybody. And so I think, but I do think that Taylor Swift kind of is this sort of interesting lens to look through in terms of who J.D. Vance is versus who Donald Trump is. And in some ways, that actually makes J.D. Vance far scarier. And not just J.D. Vance, you know, the other individuals that are hoping that, you know, they can prop up Donald Trump and he's kind of the figurehead as they push forward and, you know, move forward with these very draconian policies in so many ways. You know, Project 2025 is not a blip. It's not a joke. You know, they, as much as they try to distance themselves from it, it's a real thing. And you look at Agenda 47, Donald Trump's platform, and it's roughly the exact same thing, you know, but there just might not be the same kind of conversation happening around it.
Well, just a couple of things as we leave Vance, hopefully we can leave him in the dustbin of history. One is that, and I know it's always a mistake to invoke the Nazis, but remember that the Nazis did give bonuses, you know, cash bonuses to families who had multiple children, right? Creating more children for the Reich. And that for J.D. Vance, he said the other day, and this is the other thing, Abby, he just says weird stuff. And the things he says are
weird.
Yeah, he's really weird with the eyeliner and everything else. But he said that, you know, people aren't having kids because of car seat laws. Now, let me just say this is, again, I'm not sure, has he ever met his children? Does he like his children? Because, yes, car seats, you know, when our kids were born, we lived in California, and you actually went to, I think, a fire station or something and had the guys make sure that they were installed correctly, which was good because they were not. But, you know, again, the idea that, like, you're not having kids because the car seat laws are too onerous. I mean, this is like once you have that child. And again, we could go down a whole other rabbit hole. Isn't that child now your most precious possession? Shouldn't you want to protect it? And not only that, I think there's another part, too, which is a lot of the Americans, I assume, who have decided or not having kids probably don't own frickin' cars anyway. Right. So, like, it's just it's so, so weird. It's so weird. All right. Well, let's move from the insane to the hard to determine, the hard to distinguish, the hard to divine, which is polling. You know, last week there was a survey. I don't remember who it was. It had Trump up like 47, 46 nationally, but it had Kamala Harris up 4 or 5 points in Pennsylvania. And, you know, we're going to see a lot of this stuff, more and more of this. First, I think we should also remember that like 2 years ago, we're likely to start seeing a whole bunch of BS red wave polling come out that shows Trump up a couple of points here, up a couple of points there, just because they're trying to skew Real Clear Politics averages and those other sort of polling aggregators that are online. And they remember that they're smart enough, and Simon Rosenberg and I talked about this on our episode, they're smart enough not to make it like 4 or 5 points, right? They're smart enough to keep it close, but they want to give the impression that Trump and or Republicans are stronger than they are. And then I think I saw somewhere, Abby, that the New York Times was implementing in their survey work, a Republicans plus 5 turnout model, which is 5% more Republicans would turn out than Democrats, which, again, can only be the idea that they don't feel like they're tracking Republicans enough, so they think there's more Republicans out there. My cynical belief is that they're afraid to get it wrong again, like they did in 2016.
The needle.
Yeah, they're fudging the needle a little bit in order to make Trump look stronger. Again, none of this is to say that I don't think that it will be very close. But again, and I've talked about this on so many episodes, you know, not only on this show, but on other shows, that, you know, modern polling is not that much different from polling when I first started in politics or when my dad was in politics. You know, there's very few, as far as I know, young, hip pollsters. There might be a few out there, right?
Yeah.
but I can see that there's a lot of, you know, and I don't spend a lot of time on Republican campaigns anymore, but a lot of Democratic campaigns are trying to trade data analysis for polling. Is it which is more accurate? Now, I think if you have the money to do both, you should do both. It still doesn't make up for a good campaign with a good candidate and a good message and all of that. But it is one of those things where now we are thrown so much red meat in this polling thing. And I think, Abby, I'd always be interested to see what you think, is that the media sometimes is conducting this research and then they make their own news out of it, right? But also they love a horse race because it's easy, you know. Person A is at 51, person B is at 49. What does that tell us? You know, then there's a registered voter screen, you know, people who have registered but may or may not actually participate. Then there's a likely voter screen, who people who have said, or by based on whatever, you know, analysis they did prior to contacting these people, that they show up a lot. So I'd be curious how the media, from your perspective, plays into all this.
Well, I think, you know, looking back to 2016, obviously, a lot of people got a lot of stuff wrong, right? And that was kind of the way it shook out. And actually, you know, kind of bouncing off what you just said, I guess, you know, to me, the way that I look at polls now is relative, right? And so, you know, you look at where Kamala Harris is now versus where Joe Biden was. Like, I don't necessarily know that you take it without a grain of salt, you know, that she's neck right. and neck with Trump nationally, but like that she's neck and neck with him nationally. And then, you know, doing X in Pennsylvania or Y in North Carolina and Georgia. But I guess, like, you know, really sort of the way in which, as a member of the media, that I look at it is like, okay, where is Kamala Harris today versus where Joe Biden was? Kind of more suggestive of, you know, the winnowing down of an enthusiasm gap more than anything. And kind of taking it as, okay, where are we today versus where were we 2 weeks ago? And really kind of trying to couch it in like the polls are the polls, but let's compare the polls to the polls, right. for lack of a better way to put it. But I guess kind of my question to you, you know, when you're talking about this idea of effectively, you know, Republican poll outfits kind of juicing the stats, like, how does that impact somebody like me who's coming in and trying to like make it relative, you know, as to say, is she gaining momentum? Is she not? Is Trump gaining momentum? Is he not? You know, if this is something that they're doing.
Yeah, it is. It's thumb on the scale stuff, because if you think about it, in 2022, it was going to be the red wave. It was going to be the red wave. It was going to be the red wave. And then Election Day came around and it wasn't. That the polling was wrong, except that I think that that's true, but it's not a complete answer, which is, to your point, if you're throwing in a whole bunch of garbage research and garbage data in order to skew a potential outcome in the hopes that you will create the outcome you're desiring, then, yeah, it's very easy to say, look, this is data. But I think your first point is more important, which is I tend to look at, you know, head-to-head polls more in the idea of trends and momentum, to your
right.
point.
Right.
Joe Biden was losing to Donald Trump after the debate. I think that's a pretty objective perspective. I don't think I'm upsetting anybody by saying that. But we should also know that all of the enthusiasm and all of the money and all of the attention that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz have enjoyed since they ascended, let's say, 8 weeks ago, have brought the race to even. I mean, that's how much work they had to do. That's what their teams needed to have happen just to get the place into fighting trim and to get the race into competitive. And it wasn't just the, you know, okay, well, Trump was beating Biden by six. It was also, you know, just a complete lack of enthusiasm on the ground, right? There were offices open, but nobody wanted to volunteer. And now, as I've said ad nauseum, I promise I won't say it again until I go to North Carolina next weekend, that now the volunteer offices are full. Now the phone banks are full. Now people are getting texts. Now people are writing postcards. And so I think that stuff ultimately matters because, you know, regardless of what a poll says, you know, everybody's like, oh, the only poll that matters is on Election Day. Well, that's true. It's usually something that someone who's losing says. But the truth is that I think that we should assume, like, you know, it's the old trope, right? If you're 10 points up, act like you're 10 points down, right? If you're 1 point back, act like you're 5 points back or 10 points back, right? Like, you got to do all you can. And I think this is where the campaigns do matter on the margins, which is the Trump campaign. I mean, ironically enough, hired Ron DeSantis' political people to run his get out the vote operation, his ground game, funded by Elon Musk. They've now fired not one, but two canvassing operations. I mean, it's a little funny to me, Abby, and just sort of this, like, you know, the worst, like, farce of Game of Thrones, like a Saturday Night Live version of Game of Thrones, where, like, you'd hire your political nemesis to do something that's so hugely important to the outcome of your race when, you know, I'd be like, oh, sure, we'll do your turnout, Donald. You bet. Right. Like, I mean, just like, what? But again, Trump's never run a campaign. Trump runs a reality TV show and his name happens to be on the ballot in 50 states.
Yeah. I guess, like, how do you, kind of given your experience and given your knowledge, like, how do you explain a situation wherein you have, you know, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris in a dead heat nationally and then her up, you know, 5-6 points in Pennsylvania? Like, how do we explain that? Like, what do voters kind of, like, how do we square it? What should people think about it? You know, because it seems interesting.
Sure. So this is the vagary of the Electoral College. Everybody knows who's going to win California. Everybody knows who's going to win Idaho. Everybody knows who's going to win Oklahoma. Everybody knows who's going to win Illinois. right? But if a pollster is out there doing a quote unquote national survey of registered Republicans and Democrats and independents, you know, maybe they are trying to get some geographic distribution and they're trying to get some party ID distribution and some demographic distribution, but they're not surveying in just the 7 or 8 electoral college states that are ultimately going to matter, if that makes sense. Now, I'd love to tell everybody who lives in one of those states that I just mentioned that your vote is crucial, and it is, but also not determinative. It's important, but not determinative of the presidential election. If you live in Michigan, it is. If you live in Wisconsin, it is. And so that's what I think you see, is that when you go into an individual state, like we mentioned Pennsylvania at the top of the show, you are asking voters there. But again, I think the whole thing's a little wonky, because getting someone to participate in a survey nowadays, whether or not that's on a home phone that very few people have, or you're one of those people, no offense to these people that do this, who answer their cell phone on numbers they don't recognize, even if it says spam risk on it, right? You've already sort of self-selected. And then you've chosen to stay on the phone with a stranger for 35 minutes. You know, conversely, maybe it's being done through Facebook. Maybe it's being done online. You're part of a, you know, some sort of panel that you get 85 cents for finishing a survey, whatever the case might be. And so, yeah, it comes down to, distribution of respondents in a national survey and then the methodology, right? I mean, it all gets very nerdy. I'm not good at math. I once did a regression analysis out of a textbook, and I was amazed myself that I figured it out. But if you asked me to do it right now, I would not be able to. And so I think, again, a lot of this is just, we love polls because, again, it's easy. It doesn't take into the vagary of the Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania or the Wow counties in Wisconsin, or, you know, what are the outlying neighborhoods in Maricopa in Arizona doing? Is Clark County, you know, going to turn out for Kamala Harris? Are the all important, 8,500 votes in Elko in northeastern Nevada finally going to matter? What about white men in Reno, Abby?
I'm constantly worried about all those white men in Reno, just like wondering if they're being underpolled, underrepresented, right? You know, all those white men in Reno.
They live in the biggest little city in the world. So, but I mean, it can get, and again, we go from, a narrow aperture to a wide aperture is the difference between making it clear for a reader, right? Like you would have to making it, just a whole bunch of collection of data points, that there are people who are very skilled at sort of divining what they're seeing, not only in the top lines, right? The answers to the questions you see in a survey, but also what we call the crosstabs, white women 18 to 24, in this part, do this. And that's what really a lot of the pollsters inside campaigns are looking at, is what am I doing with the specific voter cohort? Again, whether or not it's young women, whether or not it's middle-aged guys, whether or not it's African-American men, from 25 to 34. So there's a lot of people slicing and dicing this. I think just going back to the Trump campaign directly, the problem that the Trump campaign has, and Tony Fabrizio, Trump's longtime pollster, the biggest problem he has is that the numbers are probably pretty bad, but he certainly can't tell his boss that, right? So that's, I think, another important part that goes back to all of this stuff, like we talked about with Georgia, is the whole thing is predicated on the idea that you can't tell the guy he's losing, because A, he doesn't believe it, B, his people don't want to believe it, and C, if you tell him he's losing and he believes it, then the people he most needs to cause trouble as we approach election day aren't going to do that. And so it's just this big collected glob mess of, lies, misinformation, disinformation, anger, unwillingness to believe reality, willingness to do anything to win, that gets us to American politics circa 2024.
So when you're looking at it, and when you're looking at the polls, like, is kind of the advice, obviously we've mentioned Real Clear Politics, which is great, nonpartisan. It's such a good resource for everything kind of compiled in one spot. But do you think that, a better approach to reading polls and understanding is to say okay, here's Morning Consult 2 weeks ago, here's Morning Consult today, not looking at the overall average, especially if you do have some of these other polls that might be trying to juice the stats, for lack of a better way to put it? Is it really safer to say, same poll, same kind of approach? Where were we 2 weeks ago and what does the trend look like?
100%. I think that's very smart. And I think that's right. Because again, with Real Clear Politics and these other aggregators, they're just throwing everything in the mix, right? What's the horse race look like? All right, it's 49-47 Harris. It's 50-48 Trump. It's 51-49 Harris. Without taking into account any of the underlying stuff, they're just looking at two numbers and saying, this is where we are. And so, I think that the trend is a much better thing. Where were we a week ago? Where are we now? And so now I would assume that both campaigns and U.S. Senate campaigns that have the money are now into what we're calling tracking polls, right? They're in the field every night, not with big samples, but maybe 200 or 300 person samples, which are small, I know, but statistically significant quantitatively. And they're looking at that. What's changed? And, you know, I know that on the 2004 campaign, when I worked for George W. Bush, it was like a visit from George W. Bush into a given media market was worth like 2 points in the overnight tracking, right? He got a 2-point boost from having been in a local media market the day before or whatever. And so I'm sure they're looking at that too, which is, you know, I mean, I can't speak for the Trump campaign because they don't make any sense. But the Harris campaign, I'm sure they're like, okay, Harris is going to go here. Waltz is going to go here. But it's going to be the same, you know, 25 or 30 cities across five states, right? It's not going to be surprising. You know, I think the vice president was just in Madison. Governor Waltz was just in Northeast Pennsylvania. Like, that's where they're going to be. That's where the votes are. And so, you know, and I assume that they're going to those places again, either because they need enthusiasm, they're looking for earned media, because there's so much broadcast television on the air that nobody's paying attention to that garbage. And so, yeah, that's how all this stuff sort of mixes into what you call, quote unquote, strategy.
I see. Can you imagine being Trump's pollster? Also, as an aside, like, what a horrible job.
Yeah.
Like, what a terrible, terrible job. Like, one of the worst jobs you could have.
I know. It's sort of like the mixture of court jester who has to hold up the mirror so the emperor can see he has no clothes on, right? It's just like not a good gig. Not one that's good for your longevity. Anyway. All right, Abby. So here we are again, 6 weeks-ish away from Election Day. So we will be back on the air a week from today. But before we let you go, where can our listeners find you online?
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So on X, formerly Twitter, I'm at Abigail Tracy. That's A-B-I-G-A-I-L-T-R-A-C-Y. And then on Instagram, I'm at Abby Tracy, A-B-B-Y-T-R-A-C-Y.
All right. As always, gang, you can find me on Substack, also at the home front, on Twitter and TikTok, at Reed Galen, on Threads and Instagram, at Reed_Galen USA. Abby, thanks again. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Reed.
Everybody else, we'll see you next time.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.